You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to another episode of Ethnosynology. I'm your host, David Ian Howe, and today we're getting back to dogs, which I'm sure a lot of you are very happy to hear. This episode is going to be just the TED lecture that I have on my YouTube from years ago. I'm putting that here as a podcast episode because, one, I've been saving it for a rainy day to do so, and two, I am finally ready to do another version of this, and since I've never posted this on to the podcast itself, we're going to just do that here. So this is everything I knew about dogs up until 2022. Now, I have a lot more to say, and I'm going to be doing another lecture, so please, if you're not subbed to this podcast already, please sub to it and everything else on the Archaeology Podcast Network, and sub to my YouTube, where you will see a new version of this. I'm going to, as of recording this today, it is January 27th, I will be going to Mexico in February for 3 weeks, learning from some Mexican anthropologists, Mexican archaeologists, seeing some stuff myself and talking with people that work with dogs there and adding a lot more to the lecture about that, especially the mythology angle and things like that. But with all that said, I feel like I should post this here if you haven't heard it on the podcast yet or haven't heard the YouTube video. The YouTube video has a lot more, you know, artwork and things that are engaging to listen to. But here on this one, it's the extended long cut of it. Please listen to it here and just know that there will be another one. If there's things in here that you're like, that might not be correct or I want to hear more about that, you will in the next one that's coming up sometime this year. So thank you very much. Please be sure to rate and view the podcast. And without further ado, let's talk dogs, archaeology, history, and ethnocynology. But, you know, what can you do? So here we go. I like to start the lecture off with this illustration. I work with an artist named Ettore Mazza. He's Italian, clearly. And he is a graphic novel artist, and he designs, like, comic books and graphic novels and things. And I reached out to him and was like, hey, could you illustrate for me, like, a prehistoric dog burial? Because no one had really painted that before, and I hadn't seen it. So, and I can't really had trouble picturing things, so I was like, I want this, I want a shaman, I want a family, I want men, women, and children, I want them to have tattoos, I want them to have jewelry, and he said, got it. So he made that, and the reason I show this before every lecture is people in the past, like, we have this idea that they were, like, shirtless dudes with a rock smashing a mammoth over the head. That's just not how it was. These people were sophisticated. Like I said, they have tattoos, jewelry, they have some kind of ceremony going on. This is in the Czech Republic about 13,000 years ago is what we modeled this after. Regardless, I just show that because somebody about 50, 60,000 years ago, you could have put them through kindergarten through high school and they could probably pass the standardized tests that we do today. So these people weren't dumb. They had to fine tailor clothing for the ice age because it's cold. So if you see somebody running shirtless in an illustration with mammoths, just don't even watch it anymore. So anyway, I'll get in. No matter what corner of the earth you travel to, you know, be it the unforgiving Kalahari in Africa, be it the, you know, shores of the Arctic tundra, or even the scattered archipelagos of the inconceivably vast Pacific Ocean, you will undoubtedly find a flourishing culture of talkative, fire-wielding apes. And among meeting those simians, you know, you're also going to find a small talkative wolf. And I find that to be, like, one of the most remarkable things on the planet. A quick anecdote, this is the Iroquois, or the Haudenosaunee. You know them as the Seneca, the Onondaga, the Mohawk, the Oneida, and the Cayuga. And they joined together, made a league, the League of Iroquois, and have a lot of shared mythologies. And one that I found super fascinating was one by the Seneca. And just another side note here, these people lived in such a complex civilization. They had a full representative democracy. They built their houses out of trees, but then used tree bark for siding, and they had 8 families that could live inside it at the same time, giant palisades around their villages. It was frankly remarkable to me. And they also had a matriarchy. So in that representative democracy, the grandmother had the final say in what went on, and then they went to war. But in this anecdote, in the time of creation, dogs had the chance to be human. However, due to their promiscuous and otherwise uncleanly behavior, they were denied that right. So humans taking pity on them
allowed them to come sit by the eternal fire and they can be with us. So the other animals shunned them, humans accepted them. And you will find throughout most dog research you'll ever do in world mythology that there is human, there is animal, and then there is dog. They're their own category, and I will prove that to you as we go. This is from an informant or an ethnographer that was out in this area. And he said that it's true that whenever a person loves a dog, he derives great power from it. Dogs still know all we say, only they are not at liberty to speak. If you do not love a dog, he has power to injure you with his renda, like a type of karma. So the more you love your dog, the more good magic you get from your dog. The more you treat your dog badly, the worse your magic is. That is very common throughout the world. I thought that was a pretty anecdote. Anyway, all dogs are the genetic descendants of a gray wolf species. Tomorrow, another paper will come out and say it's a different type of gray wolf. I don't care, it's a wolf. We call it gray wolf. The Canis lupus is the main descendant or the ancestor of what dogs are. There's Canis lupus that still exists today. Whether they're the direct ancestors of modern wolf or dogs, not entirely sure, but we know it was a wolf species. Dog is Canis lupus familiaris. So that in Latin is dog wolf and then dog wolf friend. And you can say Canis familiaris, but that makes dog its own species. I prefer dog to be a subspecies of the wolf. They are a wolf adapted to life among Homo sapiens. They are the first domesticated animal. They are 10,000 years older than goats and sheep and 17,000 years older than horses, like how long we've been riding them. They've been around forever. And I like this term. My colleague, Dr. Angela Perry, uses this term and calls them a biotechnology. We see dogs as pets. In other cultures, dogs might be seen as pests or they might be seen as parasitic. But in most prehistory, dogs are a biotechnology. They are an animal that we can literally take and breed and breed and breed and genetically code to make a different one. And you can have a German Shepherd that takes out bin Laden, but you can also have a Chihuahua. And it's something that's just genetically coded to be something different, and they're all a wolf. It's crazy to me. And as I said, dogs are an extension of humanity. In every culture that I've studied that have dog things to do with them, there's just dogs in the creation stories, dogs in like mythologies, dogs in the afterlife, and we consider them just like Captain Cook got to the Pacific Islands, specifically Hawaii, and was like, holy shit, they have dogs. Like, it's just something that like dogs have always been there, and we just kind of assume that. So I'm going to put this into zoological context so we can understand wolves. I'm going to talk about dog domestication and theories, get into the science, and then I'm going to talk about ethnocynology, which is the study of dogs in human cultural contexts. I'm also going to hydrate. You guys should too. Evolutionary history. Canids first appear in the Eocene, which is like 56 million years ago, but the genus Canis, so like proper wolves that we know, don't necessarily evolve into the Pliocene. And Homo sapiens, or Homo sapiens sapiens as we are, don't really appear until the Pleistocene, which only ended 10,000 years ago. So dogs, or I should say wolves, have been here a lot longer than humans. And canids mostly evolved in the North American plains. However, the gray wolf, due to recent genetic testing, might have actually evolved specifically in Beringia, Northeast Asia kind of area in its own place. And that will play a role here in a minute. The wolves are the largest of the living canids. The dire wolf obviously once was, but we also, you can look at a dire wolf skeleton and say, wow, that's just a big wolf. And that's what people assumed for years. And then someone finally did genetic testing on them and found out they are not in the genus Canis at all. And there's going to be an issue here where you have African wild dogs, you have African painted wolves, you have dogs, you have dingoes. People like to call things dogs. It's very confusing. A proper dog is still something that's like, I don't know what it is. I'll get to the point of showing you that. So just calling something the dire wolf, for example, is misleading because it's just not a wolf. Modern wolves have an average weight of 60 to 175 pounds, and they're distinct from other canids by their cranial, dental, and behavioral traits. Wolves can consist of over 38 subspecies of wolves. It's timber wolves, red wolves, gray wolves, coyotes, dogs, dingoes, all of them. And here's where I'm talking about this confusion. So dog, wolf, same genus. Canis, Canis lupus familiaris is dog. Canis latrans is the coyote. Canis anthus is the jackal. However, there are now other jackals that are in different genuses or genera. And then there's a fox on here for whatever reason in this picture. Foxes are not wolves, they are vulpes. They are in their own class of animal. You are more related to a chimpanzee than your pet dog is related to a fox. Let that sink in for a second. That's just taxonomy. And it's very confusing when people are just like, foxes are dogs. And I've heard someone say that they have a dog that has like fox DNA in it. I'm like, you don't. You were just lied to. That's just not physically possible. Anyway, it gets confusing. But when I refer to dog, I'm talking about a wolf that is adapted to human life. Wolves live in complex social groups called packs. They usually consist of 2 to 4 families of wolves. And the basic family unit consists of one male and one female in their various offspring, and they are monogamous. Monogamy is not very common in the animal kingdom. Humans, it's debatable if we're monogamous. Some of us have been on the shit end of the stick on that one. But it's for the most part, what wolves do is stick with one person or one partner, and they put energy and effort into raising that offspring together. That's what it means by wolves being monogamous. The average pack size is about 5 to 10 wolves, but in times of severe environmental pressure, it can be up to 40 wolves. And if you think about it, that was in Yellowstone. Yellowstone, as wild as we like to think it is Jurassic Park. It's just a square that you can drive through and there's gas stations in it. It's not necessarily how wolves used to live in the wild. So what you study in Yellowstone might not be as it was in the Pleistocene. And like that being said, alpha males is this general idea that we've always had. It's not a thing that only happens in captive populations. However, outcasts are a natural phenomenon and usually dies or has to figure out its own way to survive and forage. That will come back. I want you to also know, anytime you read anything about wolves, check who the author is, check where it's coming from, because there's definitely an agenda, and it will also be completely different based on what you read. So just read as many sources as you can. Every time I read something about wolves, it's different. Alpha male's a thing, alpha male's not a thing. So, but I want you to remember complex social groups and outcasts. That'll be very important. So gray wolves are a top predator, and like humans, are ruthlessly efficient pack hunters. It can be argued that bears and felines, you know, sit at the top of the food chain, but bears are solitary foragers, and cats usually hunt at night, except for African, you know, big cats, they do their own thing, but there's no real wolves around there. What makes the wolf so deadly, in addition to its intelligence, is obviously its teeth strength and stamina, and they chase down animals as a pack, and this is another thing that makes them very similar to humans. They're persistence hunters. They continue chasing until the animal collapses from exhaustion. They don't give up. And we do the same thing. That's why we're also hairless, and we sweat. We don't have to stop to pant. The water just evaporates from our body, and like we just keep running and running and running. A wolf has to stop to pant eventually. Like I said, it's a biotechnology. Like this computer is, there's a fan on that projector. It's panting, right? It's a computer that's running, has to stop and cool off. We do the same thing, just comes through sweat. But wolves will do it by tag teaming. Like it's mesmerizing to watch. A wolf will chase and it will have to stop and pant. Another one comes, and as that's happening, that poor elk does not get a chance to stop and pant. So it gets ripped to shreds. And that's why wolves are kind of a symbol of fear for us, because it's like they also do the same thing. So canids have a long, strong snout filled with thousands of scent receptors, and their huge canines easily sink into muscle and veins and skin. They can exert 1,500 pounds of pressure in a bite. Pretty nuts. So you don't want to, you know, be anywhere near that. They also, their oral osteology is for grabbing flesh. Look at those big fangs in the front. I took this picture at the Denver Museum. They have a great collection of wolves there. They lock on and they take it down. They just all grab what they can and drag. And anything in caniformia, so that is animals that are dog-like, so seals, dogs, walruses, sea lions, bears, they're all in caniformia. They're called caniformes because they have non-retractable claws. So what dogs do and wolves do is when they grab something, they sink those non-retractable claws into the ground and then rip down. They do it very well. And they have premolars and molars, which are those big chunks in the back of their mouth there, which are carnassials. And this is designed for crushing bone. That's why your dog chews bones in the way back of their mouth, never usually the front. So this might look familiar. Your dog, I know mine does, will take its front incisors and peel the stuffed animal apart and start pulling the stuff out. But when it's chewing a bone, it does it way in the back of its mouth. That is a natural wolf behavior of chewing on bones, because those teeth are just kind of, they have to chew. Not like a rodent where it keeps growing, but it's in them. So for cat people, if you go to any planet in the solar system or another solar system that has animals, I guarantee there's a cat-like thing. They have night vision, they have claws, they always end up on their feet, and they are insane to me. They're really cool. They're a post-Neolithic and agricultural animal. Cats kind of, once we started farming and they were like, these dumb apes just have piles of wheat everywhere where these mice are and they're not eating the mice, what? So they came in, started eating the mice, and in 2022, they haven't left. So this is why your cat brings in dead animals. That's just what they do. They're a wild animal that wants to hunt. I feel terrible for cats that live in a small studio apartment in New York City, but I also feel terrible that cats completely destroyed Australia's ecosystem, but what can you do? So anyway, are they domesticated? We'll find out.
Oh, man.
Okay, today we're gonna talk about the domestication of cats, and I'm gonna try my best to explain this to you. I have a cat currently right here. Let's see how this goes. Today we're gonna talk about the domestication of cats. I got him. I got his butt supported. Hello, Biggs. Today we're gonna go back to dogs. We're going back to dogs. No cats ever again. I hate cats.
That was Alex Crave's cat. He loves me. Anyway, are they domesticated? I am not sure. We do breed cats, like you have Siamese cats that you breed specifically to be hairless and things like that, but you could breed a raccoon the same way, you know? Domestic cat, Felis catus, look at this. That is not a Great Dane and a Chihuahua. That is a wild cat and a house cat. They are the same thing. And this functional anatomy they have, if you look, a dog is like a big clamp. It clamps down on that bison's leg and grips it as hard as it can and then uses the rest of its body to pull. A cat is like a staple remover, right? Gets right into the throat or the spine, and then they can use that to carry it up a tree. If you've ever seen a video of, I guess, a cheetah carrying an antelope up a tree, it's kind of insane. And if you think about that in the Ice Age, you just saw that every Tuesday, but in Europe, and it was cold. So because of that dog chewing thing in their functional anatomy, you may come home to this, or to that, or to that, or to that, or to this. And why you come home to that is because you have a giant gray wolf from the Pleistocene, a remnant Ice Age predator, smashed into a Chihuahua-sized body, and it is really pissed off about it. It's just how it goes. So when do dogs like that come about? I would say into the Neolithic, and this is genetically evidenced too. If you think about it, with all that expansion of, you know, agriculture and complex society. And now you have people that are cobbling all day. You have people that are coopering or making barrels. You have people that are soldiers. You have people that weave. You now probably have people who specifically breed dogs to hunt, to guard, to stalk, and to pull things. And in a lot of civilizations, for food. So at this time, you would have been taking wolf social behaviors and selecting them through controlled breeding to create dogs. So if you want one that runs really fast, you'll get the Saluki. If you want one that stalks your sheep, you get the Border Collie. If you want ones for hunting, you'll get hounds. And if you want something for strength, you'll get a Husky. If you want obedience, we eventually get the German Shepherd dog. So let's say you're a pharaoh in Egypt or Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia. You have a lot of money to throw at something and you're like, I want a dog that is really fast that I can bet on, okay? Tell that Neolithic breeder to keep breeding and genetically coding that thing to be the fastest dog you've ever seen. And lo and behold, when you do that, you get the Saluki. It is an aerodynamic wolf with a longer limbs. It's much slimmer and it has a giant thoracic cavity for that pulmonary system to pump that blood through its body to run really fast. It is a biotechnology. Really cool to me. If you think about it, that's a wolf stalking. That is a Border Collie herding sheep. These are wolves surrounding bison in Yellowstone. Those are Border Collies corralling sheep. It's the same thing. We just picked it over time and over time and over time to get that result. And how do you get goats? How do you get sheep? How do you get all these animals that live in giant herds into a pen? Well, you scare the shit out of them by giving a wolf and just telling them like, hey, the wolf is gonna, or you tell the wolf, sorry, to go around and scare the sheep and get them into the pen. You're literally tricking the animals into thinking they're being attacked by a wolf. And over time, I think that's kind of changed. They're more used to dogs. They'll let them sleep with them and things. But originally, that's how it was, because they're not used to a dog existing. These people come out of Siberia just talking to wolves, and every other animal was like, what's going on? So dog domestication hypotheses. This is the Předmostí site in the Czech Republic. And there are evidence of could be dog, could be wolf, depending on the osteology or whose team you're on. And one of them has a mammoth bone in its mouth. So there is some either reverence for the wolf or the dog, or they just had some kind of importance. But the Velazar Simeonovsky painted this, and he was just showing that you have wolves hanging out outside camp eating scraps, but they also help protect against the lion that's in the top left. Also at this site, over 1,000 years, they killed over 700 mammoths. You can argue what you want about overkill. They killed 700 mammoths there. They're pretty good at it. Anyway, so natural selection. All biological organisms are subject to the pressures of their environments, right? This is just a refresher. Organisms must compete with others in order to survive, secure their resources, and pass on genetic data. Generations slowly develop adaptations to help secure those resources and their survival so they can pass on those genes. So keep that in mind. Self-domestication and the flight distance hypothesis, which I'm getting into, is the idea that wolves with more docile genes were less timid of humans. They sought to exploit human food resources. This replaces cooperative hunting for them. Perhaps populations did this, or perhaps it was just those outcasts of the pack who had nowhere else to go and needed calories, as they were predisposed to being more docile. Some would call these proto-dogs, early dogs, right? And more aggressive wolves would have stayed away from humans. Coppinger calls this the flight distance hypothesis, and that is the fight or flight instinct of wolves. So how close they are willing to come to humans and how fast they will run away. Those who could stand to be around humans longer had a lesser flight distance. The ones that had a lesser flight distance eventually were the ones that became scavenging proto-dogs outside camps. That's the hypothesis. If you see dogs today around the world, this is Mexico City, that behavior has not changed. It is a wolf adapted to life among Homo sapiens. And if you come home to this, you'll also understand that is a wolf adapted to life among humans. You leave, it doesn't have access to bison to hunt in a giant herd, but it does have access to some Taco Bell that is in the trash from the day before. It's gonna eat it. Symbiotic mutualism hypothesis. This is a selection for decreased aggression. This is also a natural selection theory. This is the idea that wolves and humans are very similar animals in the animal kingdom. They are both efficient and intelligent predators. They hunt the same type of large game, specifically reindeer in Siberia. And they live in complex social groups. Wolf behavior is among, I wouldn't say great ape levels, like complexity, but it's pretty complex. And they would have competed very closely. Wolves may have caught a bleeding animal that a human hunted. Sometimes the hunt doesn't go right and the animal runs away. So you chase it down for 2 hours, you find there's wolves eating it, and you're like, well, damn it. So you could have found those wolves, popped them, and then taken the kill back. Or maybe you clearly heard a wolf kill somewhere, you ran up to it and took a bunch of atlatls, got the wolves, then you got wolf pelts, and then you also have the game that they took down. You didn't have to waste the calories. Close contact would have occurred either way. I can't guarantee that situation happened, but could have. Oh, right, so this would have allowed humans for the more docile wolves to stay close, and you reward them for your behavior. So say the one that has its ear bitten off, you call it Van Gogh, and you're like, okay, that dog is nice. And you throw it some meat, it's gonna not eat you the next time. That might just happen over time. Then you kill the aggressive, or the aggressive run away. Here we go. So I read this in David Meltzer's book. Think about this. Bison have been among wolves, as long as gray wolves have lived in North America. They know how wolves operate. They know how to surround themselves. They know how to defend themselves against wolves. They don't know how to do that against Homo sapiens. So they scatter and do erratic things. However, if people put wolf pelts on, they know how the bison are going to react. They can predict the movements and they know exactly what they're going to do. So they would crawl up to these bison, take the pelt off, I'm assuming, and then shoot it with an arrow, which you can see in the guy's left hand there. I think that's a fascinating, just one, tactic. And then two, what Meltzer posits is that perhaps when we left Africa and got to Eurasia and we're like, what are all these animals? Like, you would have watched wolves do it and figure it out from there, because you have monkey see, monkey do, I guess. So domestication theories, artificial selection, and this is human selecting for certain traits or controlled evolution. And Darwin was fascinated by this. He loved pigeons and plants. Spoiler alert, he talks about evolution, but the entire book, it's just about pigeons until the last page. And he noticed that while selecting for certain traits, like he wanted longer beaks, he got other undesired traits, which would be spotty coats, smaller feet, fluffier feathers, things like that. He never figured this out, and he just, you know, just said, for like years. Does anyone know who figured that out? Not Paris? Because you answered it last time. It was Mendel, Gregor Mendel. And Mendel lived contemporaneously with him right across the channel. And like, had they met and worked together, it'd be interesting to see where we're at. But another thing I really want to point at too is in The Origin of Species, we like think of it as like this, it is a historical book, right? But it's kind of a great piece of literature. And there's two really interesting things here that's kind of a side note. But he says like, thus from the war of nature and from famine and death, the most exalted object of which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. That is the only time he uses the word in the book. However, he got so much flack for it, he had to change it. And in the second edition, he had to add, breathed by the creator. But like, it is a wonderful piece of literature. That last bit, you can hear David Attenborough, Richard Attenborough, the Planet Earth guy, hear him read it on YouTube. It's awesome to hear. Have been and of being evolved. It's like, great. But anyway, the idea that ancient peoples adopted wild wolf pups. This is the Pinocchio hypothesis, part of artificial selection theories. You're selecting for certain traits. And this is praising those with them and killing or releasing those without them. And the problem with this, besides sticking your hands into a wolf den, like that's an issue on its own, they're wild wolves. They're not domestic dogs. They don't have that domestic biology, which I'll get into. Like a wolf requires constant training to be just to sit. Like you can't just expect it. You can't bring it inside. So it requires constant training. I don't know if this would have been the case immediately, but maybe down the line, this was a theory that would have happened. But it's difficult to train a wolf, right? They're unpredictable, no domestic biology. But another artificial selection theory that is interesting is Dmitry Belyaev, a Soviet geneticist in the Soviet fox experiment. He was asked to breed silver foxes to make the furs easier to get, like make less aggressive foxes. And being a geneticist, he was like, let me do a study. And he bred only docile foxes with docile foxes, and he made the aggressive foxes breed as a control, which is a good science experiment. What happened, though, would have made Darwin dance in his grave. Within 20 generations, the foxes began to bark, had spotted coats, multicolored coats, their ears went floppy, their tails began to wag, and they were genuinely excited to see people. He made a domestic fox, and they looked more juvenile into adulthood. This is called neoteny. The aggressive group he called dragons, which in Russian is dragon. And they had extremely high adrenaline levels. So the reason this study, besides the cages being just abhorrent, if you look at what they were in, it's kind of sad, is that he was arguing that adrenal and aggression DNA is somehow linked with these traits. So that can get into some dicey topics later on. But the point is, he made domestic foxes, and he kind of showed that in just quick generations, you can make a dog. This is neoteny. The fact that, so I just heard reactions from some of you already, right? The fact that you're having a reaction is neoteny. We breed these animals to look more docile into adulthood. This is my puppy when he was 6 weeks old, but he has that face of a baby, right? Like we even breed pugs. They're a loaf of bread with feet, but their face is to look like a human. And like, that's what we're going for. And you get that same response as if you're looking at a baby. So at this point, Darwin would have been like, oh, capital. That's like exactly what I was trying to figure out. But I talked about pigeons for 9 hours. Put this into context, and we'll move on to the next part. Humans leave Africa, we start to settle the world. We get all the way to Australia, eventually down to the Americas, all over. And in the Eurasia, it's a harsh environment. It's the Ice Age. Food is hard to forage. You have to hunt. There's also very large predators there that are trying to eat you as well. You're going to have to live in caves and structures, but also during the day, you have these wolf-like creatures that are outside, or just wolf creatures, and they're also efficient, intelligent, and adaptable species. Humans are an invasive species out of Africa, probably the most invasive species on the planet, second only to kudzu. But we lived in caves or structures. They had to hide from bears, cats, and wolves, but wolves are there during the day. We had to compete. So let's say one day after the hunt, a wolf follows you home, and it begins to scavenge outside your cave. You're a little scared, so you just throw it a bone to keep it at bay. But if you do this for a couple thousand years, you're giving a mouse a cookie, right? It's going to keep coming back. So you know which ones are nicer. You know if Van Gogh is not going to bite you. You let them live around your camp. You raise Van Gogh's puppies, and they're socialized around you. So maybe at that point, you're picking puppies up out of the dens, you know, that are of nicer wolves. So at this point, now you have what we would call human's best friend. Wolves and humans have similar social systems. We have monogamy and behavioral rearing that is similar. The proto-dogs, or wolf dogs, would have began to rely on Homo sapiens for food. It's a good trade-off. Nothing wants to mess with a wolf, they also help protect us, and they help us hunt. If you've ever walked through a neighborhood and just heard dogs barking and barking and barking and barking, like I heard this in Georgia when I was walking with a friend a year ago now. Like, we couldn't talk because there were so many dogs in this like cul-de-sac barking. And like, I was thinking, like, how did people exist in the past without that? Because if there's a tiger outside your camp, it's going to perk up and bark. I guess you just had a lot of fire, or you listened really hard for it. But begin selectively breeding the pups, and you killed Dmitry Belyaev's dragons, but you praised the dogs. Now you have a domestic wolf. There is a theory posed by Pat Shipman that humans moving into Eurasia or further into Europe might have helped push Neanderthals towards extinction. I don't really think extinction's the right word. I would say that we kind of just intermixed. But like, humans coming in with dogs would have allowed them to come in a lot faster. However, as she puts in the book, there's no evidence for dogs at this point, but I had this picture drawn anyway. And if you look in the background, any picture I do with a Tori, there's a wolf in it somewhere, just to make sure. Ethnocynology, that's the study of dogs in human cultural contexts. We have dogs in our homes, right? In most places in the world. We love them, we show them love. We had it illustrated in, I believe this was Moravia, somewhere out in Eastern Europe, with a dog. And coastal Georgia here, they're foraging fish and shellfish off the shore, probably near Savannah. And they use the dog because in the Americas, there are no horses, there are no camels, there are no draft animals. There are llamas in South America, but they don't really do much for people in Georgia. And you only have dogs to carry things, so you would have used them for backpacks and hauling. And in most societies that I've read about, it is women that do most of the rearing of puppies until they're either hunting dogs that go out with men that are hunting, or otherwise it's just usually something like dogs stay among the women and the children, which I thought was pretty interesting. I just think is a fascinating fact, dogs existed while we were still hunting mammoths. So like, this scene could have just been happened. You know, it's like, that just blows my mind. Just elephants. We found one this summer in outside Cheyenne, just an elephant eroding out of the ground. Crazy to me. Cave hyenas, Cracuta cracuta spalea. They are larger, louder, they have longer legs, and they are a lot faster than the modern spotted hyena. They are probably a very intimidating thing to find. Caves in Europe have hyena bone caches in them. There are some caves in Europe that have human hair in hyena feces. So they were eating us. They're a formidable predator. But also, hyenas are a kleptoparasite. They steal the kill of another animal. Have you ever watched hyenas interact on the savannah? The lion will hunt the animal, but like, the hyenas will come around that lion and just keep biting at it and laughing and doing that weird hyena thing until the lion gives up. An incredible animal. There are hyenas all throughout Europe until about 15,000 years ago. About 15,000 years ago, humans and wolves live in Siberia together, and the first domestic dog biology occurs. Once cave hyenas are gone, people start entering the Americas. I think that's a fascinating correlation. And we get to the Americas, there are giant ground sloths, there are horses, there are lions, there are mammoths, there are giant short-faced bears. I would not want to brave that continent alone without a wolf that I could talk to. But we don't know if dogs existed in the Americas At this time, we know they existed at by 10,000 years ago, but during the initial Paleo-Indian migrations, I would like to think so. We also, as I said, Cook got to Polynesia and was like, wow, they have dogs. Cook also kind of understood these people probably came from Asia too. He didn't think they just sprang out of holes in the ground there like the Spaniards did when they got here, which I thought was fascinating. But if you think about this, the Polynesians understood ocean swells, what times of year like those changed. They knew the star charts without written language. They knew how to find lagoons under atolls, reflected under clouds, like in the distance. It was like insane human ingenuity. But also when the populations on one island got too big, they had to expand to the next one, and they knew how to do that with those navigation like ideas. And they also had to bring with them potable water, and they had to bring food. So they brought with them chickens and pigs, which is why there's a chicken in Moana, that Disney movie. But they also brought with them domestic dogs, and those would help them hunt and find things. And it's an emergency food source if you need it to be too. But just to think about all of that, you just go into the literal unknown on the ocean and you bring a dog with you. I just think that's like remarkable. Anyway, there's a lot of like positive stuff we can say about dogs too, but once we get to the Neolithic and population just skyrockets, we also get stray dogs and pariah dogs. A lot of places in the world, dogs are seen as parasites. They steal food. They have fleas. They have diseases. You don't want to be near them. Some of them are treated well. Some of them are not. This is a side effect of the Neolithic. So let's get into some scientific evidence. The scientific evidence for this would be the dog was present, we know genetically, by 20,000 years ago in East Asia. And this is like in the Siberia area where those wolves and humans were stuck in that glaciated environment. So they had to either die out or adapt to invasive Homo sapiens, and that's how the dog became to exist. And that is up in East Asia. Proto-dog remains, though, have been found in human caves all over, especially Belgium, Siberia, and Germany. And those date back as far as 30,000 years ago. And think about it, world evolution is not Pokemon. You don't just give something a stone or get it to level 34 and it evolves into a Blastoise. It takes gradual time. It takes a long time. And I went to a conference in Rome a few years ago, and they were passing the mic around with a translator to the French, to the Israelis, to the Germans, and then to the Canadians and the Italians, all arguing whether or not that is a wolf or that is a dog. And it was a skull that was from the specific site. And if you look at it, top one's a wolf, bottom one's a dog. It's the same species. Just one has that neotenous trait to it, right? It gets scrunched in more. And the reason dogs are a little more social with humans is because when that brain case gets squished in more, the social parts of the brain, or I'm not sure exactly how all that works. I'll leave that to the other nerds. But that's how like their social biology changes from wolves. But they are essentially the same dog. Tangent over, how do you know when you find something that looks in between that? Is it a wolf? Is it a dog? Is it a dog that just had a weird tumor? Is it something in between? Don't know. So what we can only really do is go with the genetic evidence. So archaeological evidence. Bonhoeffer Castle, Germany. First dog burial that exists 14,000 years ago, or almost 15,000. This was a puppy that had canine distemper. Canine distemper healed, but then later on, because of malnutrition, the puppy died, like a couple months later. And some people say that this is a wolf, it's not a puppy. Again, I don't care. It is the first time a human put a canid-like creature into the ground with them with reverence. That is important. We also have, and this is what got me into archaeology in general, this was on a textbook cover in my undergrad, this is Ein Malacha in Israel, 12,000 years ago. That is an Natufian woman, Natufian. These are the first people to settle down in the Epipaleolithic, in an area that was eventually became the Fertile Crescent and the Levant. You didn't have to forage and move all around all year. You could stay in one spot because everything was abundant. They started sowing seeds. They stayed in one spot. They also had dogs. And you can see here, this middle-aged woman was buried, and under her hand by her skull there is the bones of a puppy. And I thought about it at that time because I was bored in class as an undergrad. Did the puppy die and then the woman died? Probably not. The woman probably died, and then they sacrificed the puppy. Or in a third case, the puppy died, and then the woman was like, I'm out. but probably not. The puppy was probably sacrificed to be with the woman, and that is something that is like very common in the archaeological record, and I'll get more into that. But the oldest dog in the Americas that is buried is the Coster site in Illinois, and it was just buried pretty neatly, and it ate a lot of fish. And what's cool about that paper that this came from is you can understand human diets by looking at the isotopes that are in dog bones, right? You can see what the dogs are eating, likely through human feces or through human trash. Semiotics, right? This is a linguistic part of dog anthropology or ethnocynology. You have semiotics. You can point, you can gesture. An animal understands that from you. You can verbally command, you can talk, you can train. I can talk to my dog in English or Spanish if I wanted to, and he'll still learn it. It's just he knows come means that and he'll get food, you know? Like he doesn't understand the syntax of English, but he knows what that means. And then there's also language. I'm not the biggest fan of this term, motherese, but my cultural professor, Dr. Strauss, had me read this book called How Forests Think by Eduardo Cohn. And it was a study in the Amazon. These people in the Amazon would blow ayahuasca up the dog's snouts, and they would hold the dog's nose, and they would be like, do not eat the trash, like while it was tripping balls. And like the point of that, I couldn't really figure out in the book, but they felt in that state, the dog could understand more, and they were on the same plane, and they could communicate. And I was like, that is fascinating. That's why she wanted me to read this book, I guess. I thought that was cool. And there's just like these all little cultural things you can do with dogs, and every culture has them. Art. You look at this painting in Chauvet. There's aurochs, there's some rhinos, no humans, no dogs or wolves. This is Lascaux. There's aurochs, there's megaloceros, there's more horses. Are there no humans because you don't want to scare the prey away? Are there no dog or wolves because you don't want to scare the prey away? I don't know. There are, however, cave hyenas, bears, and a lot of lions. Those would scare the prey away. I don't know why there's no humans, and I don't know why there's no dogs. Also, fun fact, we know that hyenas in the past in Europe were spotted because of that exact illustration right there. The only evidence of dogs in cave paintings comes from Font de Gaume in France. And this is only like 10,000 years old. It's not as old as the others. And it's possibly a wolf or a dog, not sure. Was it a taboo to paint them? Was it too taboo to have humans on there? Don't know, we'll never know. Later on, this was found a few years ago, rock art in Arabia. First evidence of dogs on leashes. He also has a bow and arrow. And the little like slits on the side of the dog's faces, I thought was just artistic, but apparently they are Canaan dogs. Canaan dogs have from their face down to their leg, a white stripe. So those dogs have existed a very long time. Biological anthropology. When you look at a dog or you touch a dog, you get oxytocin released. And when you breastfeed your child, that's also where oxytocin comes from. It's the love hormone, technically. It bonds you, and we get that from dogs. There's also zoonotic diseases. Dogs are huge disease vectors. They can carry fleas, they can have worms, they have tularemia if you get it to them, they have giardia, any of those things they can get just like we can. The first evidence of rabies is from a Sumerian text where it says the dog went mad and they hit it over the head. And like we can assume that means maybe rabies or the dog just went mad, but that's the first evidence I could find. There's an awesome paper by Stu Fidel that posits that humans and dogs coming into the Americas, bringing in to a virgin continent that had never seen either giant apes and giant domestic wolves coming in, brought diseases with them. What if a wolf or a dog had rabies and a saber tooth bit it, and then that saber tooth bit a mammoth? It would spread. We can't track rabies paleopathologically. You can't see it. No way to tell, but it's a cool thought. Rabies is a big thing. And there's the cooperative eye hypothesis. Every animal on the planet has giant irises. That's all you can see. Humans, though, have white sclera. Some chimpanzees do have white sclera as well, but it's not as common. So let me go back. The only other animal that has white sclera in its eyes are dogs. We evolved that in them so that we could communicate with them better. We designed them to have human faces. Biotechnology. Okay, let's get into this. First off, I had a Tori draw this one. If you think about this, just think about this scene. You are an ape that comes barreling out of the woods with a domestic wolf that you're talking to, number one. Two, you have a simple machine with feathers on the end of it that you took from a bird. lashed onto the end of that atlatl. Then you took a piece of stone from this big, smashed it down into something sharp, and then you took pine sap and charcoal, mashed it together, melted it, glued it to the end of that stick, then bit into a deer spine to take that sinew and take it wet, tie it around the end of the feathers and the thing to make it socket onto there better, to lash it. And then at the same time as all that is happening, you're chasing an animal down that is terrified for its life while you are also wearing the flayed skins of another animal on top of it. It is insane to me, and we wonder why aliens haven't come to visit us. It is like, it's the most insane thing. And if you think about it, like, what if Coco the gorilla walked in here right now with a fox, looked at it, and that said something to it, and that fox killed bin Laden? Like, that's what humans and dogs are. It's crazy. Biotechnology, though, like I said, in North America, we don't have, or we, the people who lived here, did not have horses or oxes or draft animals. They had dogs, so they strapped travois to the dogs to help carry things, usually their own water. These are Paleo-Indians, also drawn here by a friend, Dan Burr. I like to think, like, in the old world too, this is probably something that could have happened as well. Just having dogs carry things for you, it's easier. You got to feed them a lot. They're gonna eat a lot of calories while they do this, and you're gonna have to give them water a lot more because they're pulling more, but it's less stuff you have to carry. This is the Inuit. They use sled dogs. More recently in the historic record, not so much in the prehistoric that we know of. These are the Innu, I believe, or the Mi'kmaq. I can't remember exactly which nation it was. Regardless, they had dogs that only slept outside. They couldn't go inside. They weren't allowed to. They were chained up outside. They also could not eat reindeer bone. They could not eat whale bone, and they could not eat seal bone. It would offend those animals if dogs were to chew on them, because dogs are traitors to the animal kingdom, much like that Iroquois anecdote. So dogs, again, are in a different plane than human and animal. They were allowed to eat fish, though. And one dog was allowed to live with people, and it was given a name and therefore awarded a soul. So I don't know exactly why that was the case, but it's what the ethnographer wrote. And also the sea goddess in this people's mythology also has a pet dog. Mythology, moving on to the end. This is Gil Litsun Stayunyi, and that in Cherokee is the way the dog ran. And in Cherokee mythology, a dog ate from the communal vat of cornmeal, and they didn't like that, and it ran across the sky. So what the Milky Way is the cornmeal dripping from its mouth. In a lot of societies, it also has to do with food or a trail of something. I think that's interesting too, because it does look like that. We call it milk, they call it cornmeal. I just made that connection right now. So anyway, yeah, that is the mythology of the Cherokee. I'm gonna play this real quick. This is the Maya.
At a stroke, the dolls were made, carved of wood. But the wooden people had no hearts, no minds. They abused the trees and the rocks. They abused their dogs and their grinding stones. They did not think of their creator, heart of sky, heart of earth.
I'll let it keep playing.
And so they were destroyed. Their dogs tore at them. Their pots smashed their faces. And heart of sky brought a great flood. Those who escaped the great flood are the monkeys in the forest today.
But this is the Maya creation myth called the Popol Vuh, and this is a rendition of it made out of, they took hieroglyphs and Mayan pottery and then illustrated it. And if you've never done acid, this is a close anecdote to it. It's on YouTube, the full thing. It's great to watch. But the first form of people were made from mud. They were dumb. They made people from wood in the second iteration. And the wooden people obviously were stubborn. But what I'm showing you this for is that even before humans were made into their final form, it's just assumed they had dogs. Like before the humans even became monkeys in the trees. Like it's already ingrained. I think that's just a cool thing in our psyche. Romolo and Remo, Romulus and Remus. I took this picture in Rome. The hero twins, which also the Maya have hero twins in their creation story. They were left to die, abandoned in a hill. but the Capitoline wolf nursed them, and they suckled at her, and they became the first emperors of Rome. And to this day, Rome still has the symbol of the wolf. Does anyone know what SPQR stands for? It is... So is it? Or is it Senatus Populus Romanus, which means Senate and People of Rome. So like in any form of Roman government, and in the city of Rome, and in the Italian government, that wolf is still there. It is still a prominent symbol of Roman culture. I also noticed when I was in Rome, greyhounds everywhere. This is at the Vatican. This was at another museum, Capitoline Museum. And I looked into it. If you were a wealthy person in Rome, you could afford to get a fancy Egyptian greyhound. And if you had an Egyptian greyhound, it meant you had status. Thought that was really cool. But final meat of this, and I promise I can wrap this up here soon. What do these have in common? Does anyone notice anything? Death. There you go. Thank you. They all have to do with death. Fenrir, he's bound in dwarven chains, and when he breaks through those dwarven chains during Ragnarok, he swallows the sun, or I believe his sons do. Can't remember. In Native American mythology, dogs always serve as spirit guides into the spirit world, and I will get into the next three. The Greeks, Cerberus, he's Hades' dog, or Dis, I think is the other word for Hades. Three-headed dog. In some stories, he keeps people in the underworld. Other stories, he keeps people out of it. Either way, he's the right-hand man of Hades. Anubis. We call him Anubis because that is the Greek word. That's my dog. But his original name is Anpu, which means to decay. This, the oldest statues of gods in Egypt are of the jackal Anubis, or the dog. In a story, Osiris is cut to pieces by his brother Set, the god of chaos, and all they could find, well, I'm not going to get into that. They found one part of him. The dog sought it out. You can figure out what part that was. And Isis wept, and she begged Anubis to find the rest of him to put him back together. And Anubis was the first person to mummify somebody, and Osiris was the first to be mummified. Osiris is the god of death. Anubis is the god of the dead. There is a distinction there. And it's debated, is Anubis a jackal? Is he a dog? Is he a fox? And I read a paper. Again, this will get confusing, but the original jackal that they thought lived in Egypt is genetically actually a wolf. So just whatever at this point. He is an amalgamation of canids is what the paper went to. But all these dogs are always black too. I think that's interesting because they decay. But in the afterlife, when you die, you are summoned by Anubis, and Anubis takes your heart out and he puts it on a scale. And if your heart is lighter than a feather, you may pass into the underworld and meet the other gods. And I think that is interesting because when you die, you face the judgment of a dog. I also have no way to prove this, but I would think the Sphinx would make a lot more sense proportionally if it was a dog before, but I don't know. We'll get into Xolotl. Xolotl was the Aztec dog god, and he was Quetzalcoatl's dog. And in one story, again like the Maya, they had four iterations of humans and they all failed. So they're the final one. They had to go down into the underworld to find the Lord of Bones. Can't remember his name. And the Lord of Bones was like, yeah, well, you can take the bones to make the people, but you got to go all through these challenges. And they had to walk through fields of obsidian in bare feet, walk through a mountaintop that the wind blew your skin off, and another place that was freezing, and there's a place with crocodiles or alligators. Can't remember all of them. Point being, kind of an arduous journey. But Quetzalcoatl and Xolotl go down there and they get the bones. And before humans are created, there are dogs. Interesting. And the dog finds the bones. And because the god of death just felt like it, he smashed the bones up, and that's why people are different sizes today. But that is Xolotl. And in Aztec and most Mesoamerican mythologies, there's the land of the dogs. When you die, you either go to Itzcuintlatonotliu, which is the sun god place. If you die as a warrior or if you die in childbirth, you live with the sun god. I also like that childbirth is considered a form of war for them. That's poetic. You also go to Itzcuintlalocan, which is where you go if you drown or get struck by lightning, you live with the moon god. But most people go to Mictlan, which is the land of the dead. And to get to the land of the dead are all of those challenges the Lord of the Dead set forth for Xolotl and Quetzalcoatl. And you have to go through nine of them. The first one, before you get to Mictlan, is La Tierra de los Perros, the land of the dogs, which is also Itzcuintlan. It's on my notes. Anyway, Itzcuintlan, that's the word, Aztec, cool. Land of the dogs. There is a river But only if you loved a dog in your lifetime can you cross the river. Were you kind to dogs? You could go. They would help you. Your dog would likely help you if it was there, apparently is the story. In other Mesoamerican mythologies, it's just that your dog waits for you and it will take you through the nine lands of the dead so you don't have to go alone. I think that's quite poetic as well. And then there's Xolotzcuintles, right? It's Cuitlan, because Cuintle is dog. So Xolotzcuintles are Mexican hairless dogs. These were bred by families to be sacrificed when you died. So you had a dog in its Cuitlan. You didn't go alone. They were also used as beanbags when they were puppies to put on your knees when you had arthritis, like as heating pads. So again, you take a giant wolf and smash it down as a biotechnology into a heating pad. This is a pile of dogs that were found in a trench underneath an apartment complex in Mexico City, modern day Tenochtitlan. And they were laid to rest without trinkets, without anything of note. They were just there, which is interesting. Because Tenochtitlan was a gigantic Neolithic city. Didn't have metalworking to the extent that we would think of in the old world, so I would consider it Neolithic. But you had cobblers, you had weavers, there were friggin' poets there and things like that, writing systems. Montezuma had a zoo in his palace, like massive city. And when the conquistadors got there, they said that it was larger than Constantinople and they were afraid of it because it was so big. And what I find fascinating is even in such like an ancient city, which doesn't exist anymore, this is Mexico City today, they ripped down the Sun Temple and they put a Catholic church. In that city, we're just stray dogs kind of roaming the streets. And I find that kind of sad, but also it's just ethnocinology, just dogs exist where people do. I'll wrap this up here. Everything that I've talked about, if you look at this, humans start to bury each other at a certain point in time, right? It kind of marks this point in our history where we are human. We transfer this idea of like, we exist, there must be an afterlife. I personally think you gotta bury people because they're gonna start to stink, number one. So that becomes a habit that you do. Number two, you gotta bury them 6 feet deep or hyenas are gonna dig them up. So you gotta keep doing that. That becomes a ritual. And then there becomes more culture to that and it becomes a religion. And then you have the afterlife. But in 14,000 years ago, we bury a dog for the first time. So you're transferring that idea of I am human into another animal, and you put that animal into the ground with dignity. I think that is definitely a defining moment in human history. So I'd like to know, dogs have been around for 20,000 years. Again, 10,000 more than goats, 17,000 more than horses, and a lot more than llamas. They are similar to us in many ways. They play a huge role in human history and a lot of world mythologies. But I want to know, why do we associate them with death? Is it the scavenging from the hypotheses of why dogs exist? Is that just ingrained in us and we associate dogs with bone scavenging? Is it because they die sooner than us? Some of us will have 3 to 4 dogs in our lifetime, so we understand death a few times in our life. Or do we just miss them? Many cultures don't really miss dogs because they kick them. But like most societies that, you know, in Western society for sure, we do care for our dogs and have affinity for them. So I don't know. And I think about this too, that orenda, that magic that you have, that the Iroquois felt when they touched the dog. Was that magic or is that just oxytocin, that love hormone that bonds you? I don't know. It could be both. If you want to bear with me one more minute, these are Roman and Greek dog epitaphs, and I find these kind of sad. Mia never barked without reason, but now she is silent. My eyes were wet with tears, our little dog, when I bore you to the grave. So Patricus, never again shall you give me 1,000 kisses, never can you be contentedly in my lap. In sadness have I buried you, and you deservest, in a resting place of marble, I have put you for all of time by the side of my shade. Here the stone says it holds the white dog from Melita, the most faithful guardian of Eumelus. Bull they called him while he was yet alive, but now his voice is imprisoned in the silent pathways of the night. You who pass by this monument, laugh not, I pray thee, for it is a dog's grave. Tears fell from me, and dust was heaped above me by my master's hand. I have more stuff, but that's a whole other PowerPoint. Do you guys have any questions, any thoughts, comments? If you want me to go more into stuff, I can, but I know you gotta go. But thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.